Obviously, we can't go through all the questions. So what we did was we sort of grouped them together into some broad categories and thought we could, between the two of us, maybe capture some of what was asked. So we'll start with
first one. So there was this first group, which we are defining as pain in the body, precisely, discomfort, vulnerability, so emotional pain, chronic illness, and we group them together like this so everyone can see that we have similar things coming up in the collective group. So one question is, actually three questions. What do you do with the body when you have discomfort, especially chronic illness in the body? How do you sit with that? Or should you ignore it? Push through the pain? Or should you attend to it? Also, more broadly, how can we be more inclusive with different abled body people with different abilities coming into the Sangha or group, particularly like with walking meditation, because not everyone can walk? So those are some questions that we decided for this first group. So Marcella, do you have any opinions or advice on bodily pain? Because I'm 26, so I don't have any physical ailment. For a short period of time, about a year, I'm going to say that's a short period of time, I was holding a lot of grief, which is also a topic that came up a couple of times. So a lot of emotional grief on my chest, and it was manifesting in my heart. So I was having heart pain. And I had to do several kind of things to uproot this. So I tried deeper Vipassana practice to get to the emotional root of it. And that helped a little bit, but it wasn't completely gone. And I also tried just holding it with mindfulness, because I think that idea that mindfulness is like the end all is very prominent, especially in Western Buddhism. Like, mindfulness is it, but it's not it. So that pain was still there for me. So I had to shift very radically how I viewed this grief, this heaviness, this pain, because sometimes when you're doing deeper meditation, this stuff comes up. And I don't particularly like to delve into pain. So I had a lot of depression as a teenager. So grief is something I just kind of like to sweep away. So actually just holding it was kind of sweeping it away from me, because I wasn't really going into it. So I decided to leave my home monastery because I needed more movement, basically. So right now I'm doing it's pretty typical in other Buddhist traditions, doing a mendicant or wandering path. So going from different monastery to different monastery, different teacher to teacher. And for me, that shifted the grief. It shifted this heaviness I was feeling. So the whole environment needed to be shifted. And I needed to experience new stimuli. And this is something that happens often to me. It's not the first time I've had to kind of uproot and lift. I left home when I was about 16 to go to a boarding school, and then again at 19, or 21 actually, when I moved from the city to the countryside to get away from the drugs and alcohol, the people I knew, my connections, my drug dealers. So this moving for me is not necessarily a bad thing. I see it's like a pattern that I'm noticing, like sometimes I need to uproot and land in a different place. So my monastic name is Diamond Mountain. And so I'm very comfortable being stable in one position. So my practice is bringing and incorporating movement, because I'm just really comfortable being still. Stillness is great for me. Like, Kina is laughing because Kina and I lived together at the monastery for a couple of years. But So that's really my practice, to kind of go against my inclination. And that really helped shift a lot of the grief. It helped shift the pain, the physical pain that was manifesting from a lot of this emotional stuff that wasn't being processed. And I have to keep working on it. So it's not like, okay, I checked that off and now I'm done. No, because I had to continuously go back to it. Even these movements, like just before we sat down, we were doing the mindful movements and Marcella's leading that, you see, not me. So I came in and I sat down and she's like, stand up. Because yeah, I would just like to sit. That's what I would like to do. So also, not just the physical environment, but the people that you surround yourself with make a big difference. So I'm touching on for grief in particular, see the many components that might make up that grief, and see if you can start to alternate, switch, replace. There's a sutra, just to wrap up really quickly, about the Buddha uses example of a carpenter. So back in his time, they didn't have nails, they had wooden pegs. So you would, to replace the rotten peg, you would kind of knock it out and replace it with another peg. So Tay has updated that with the teaching Change the CD. So I would say like hit next on the playlist. So sometimes for me, the whole environment is the peg. A whole person might be a peg. A whole idea might be a peg that you have to replace. So just kind of playing with it and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And that's a manifestation of wisdom or discernment. So nobody can really tell you what it is. Like, you can go to a therapist and bounce ideas off of them and they can give you the reflection back, but it really comes from actually sitting and being still and figuring out what's coming up. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that with the bodily pain, when we're trying to sit, and sometimes it's very, it's so present, right? Because we sit and now we're dropping everything, and you know, a lot of the direction in meditation is go inward, leave the external, and so now it's almost like, now I'm really meeting my pain. Hello, pain. I know you're there. And in our tradition, we often say, "Hello, my pain. I'm here for you, and I'll hold you and take good care of you, and with very loving and gentle energy." But sometimes that pain is still so raw, it's still on fire, that we can't even get near it. So the fire is still so, the flames are so big that just coming near it, it burns you. It burns the heart even to come to start to hold it. And I think there's ways to practice with that. Some teachers suggest that, for example, if you have pain on one side of the body and you can't go there yet because it's so immense, that, you know, the flame is so big, you go to the other side of the body and you bring energy there. And because of this non-separation, taking care of this spaciousness here and opening the space, this will eventually add to the spaciousness over here when it reaches there. Again, it's because of, like we discussed yesterday, it's because of the non-separation of this body. So right knee's hurting, we spend energy on the breath, loving and taking good care and really creating spaciousness, opening up this space, letting the breath really find all the ways that it can go through that solid mass, that energetic mass. Because eventually it's energy, right? It's energy congealed in some form. And so the breath is energy as well. And so we're bringing a different energy, a loving energy, a caring energy, to dissipate, to open, and to neutralize that hard, congealed mass, that grief that has solidified in a part of the body, or that pain that has an inflammation that's there, that's even a solid tumor perhaps. But it's still energy. It's energy congealed as matter. So the breath is energy as well. And so basically what we're doing with the breath, if we hook into the breath and the energy, is we're bringing a different breath of air into this area that's really solid. But if we can't get there yet because it's so inflamed, then we go to the other side. And it's the same with the abdomen. If there's an area that's really tight and we can't, it's just so solid, you breathe around it, it's like a wall. And you go to the other side. If it's the front, you go to the back. Okay? When we talk about bringing the breath in and letting the breath acquaint us with the innards, basically, right? So we allow the breath energy to actually sense from inside, what does it feel in there? And no one else in this world can do that but you, because it's your body. And so eventually, as we do that, we should be able to get to the point where we take the breath in and we can feel inside of our body as we bring that breath energy all the way to our toenails, the bottom of our small toe, the tip of our fingers. This is our practice. This is why we sit in steady mind and we get still. And so when we do that, we start to notice where the blocks are. And so those big blocks that are on fire, that's shouting and is chronically inflamed, we can feel it because it's so big. But in the body, as we get more subtle, there are so many blocks in there that we actually are not aware of yet, because they're subtle, but they're there. But we've been in these lives over and over again. So we've accumulated these areas of pain, grief that has wrapped itself up in us. So as we get more subtle with our breath, we start to notice that. And the pain that we actually experience is pain that's actually, the fibers are on fire, the chemicals are burning, they're sending messages up to the nerve and it's coming back and it's saying pain. That's pain that's so big and hard and inflamed that you don't need that breath energy to detect that subtle node of pain. And so when it's so hard, it's often difficult to bring energy there. So we dissipate and we bring ease and calm and flow to the other parts of the body, so that the other parts of the body are flowing so easily that it's naturally going to flow and come and take care of that side. It's the same like the cut on the one finger and the other finger. It goes to take care of it. Inside the body, it's the same thing. As we ease one side of the body, the natural inclination, because it's one organism, is to take care of the other areas that are not flowing. This is the beauty of the practice, is to reestablish in ourselves this wholeness, this complete flow. And so we practice with the places where we can find ease, and we bring ease that will by itself take care of the areas that are painful. But that's hard sometimes, to go into the body if there's so much inflammation. And then I think we can practice with other senses. So maybe with sound. So maybe if we can't go in because it's so on fire, and you know, when you get a point of inflammation, like when I get a headache, everything else in my body is like this. It's all inflamed, right? And so it's like everything's gentle and walking very gentle. So you have to, when I breathe in at those times, it's like almost barely letting that energy move around. And sometimes then you have to maybe leave the body and focus on a sound. So our meditation becomes like we pick up one sound, some background sound, and we just focus in. Because remember, the object of meditation is really to bring the mind to stillness. So we focus on something repeatedly in such a way that the mind, it's not jumping around in every taxi that, you know, taxis are driving by, and you just jump in and you're going everywhere. No, we try to stay one pointed so that the taxis, they come, they go by, the thoughts come, they go by. You don't jump in and end up there, jump in the next one, end up there. You're actually staying steady. So when we use the breath to help us with that breath in, breath out, breath in, breath out, breath to the toe, breath back up, wherever. But if we can't go in the body, we can bring the mind's attention to a sound, and we just stay with that sound. We stay with the sound. We stay with the sound. The staying with the sound, again, it doesn't distract the mind. from jumping around. It could be a scent. Maybe there's a scent in the room that you're sitting. Yeah. But we start to use the other senses to help us come to stillness and bring the mind to stillness. Because the breath, when we do the breath in the body for pain, it's very specific. And when we bring the mind and the body still, we can start to get at the reasons that the grief and the pain is there. Because the pain is grief manifested in a physical form, right? Because every mental component has a physical component. There isn't one mental energy that doesn't manifest itself somewhere in the body physically. And true healing comes when we heal both of those things. And so like Sister Diamond was saying, what is the component that's caused that pain? Is it the physical situation? Is it a person? Is it where we are in our life journey? And those are even the harder one. You know, you take arthritis, it's okay, right? Because like it's arthritis. But when it's something in our whole life, the conditions in our life that's causing pain, those are the harder one because it requires this like real shift. So I think this understanding of looking into where our pain is coming from, not just physically in the body, but the outside circumstances, that they're all messages. They're messages to us of maybe the body's wisdom is trying to help us because the mind hasn't caught up yet.
There was one question about holding both. Mm-hmm. Grief or
lightness.
Lightness and darkness. And I just wanted to include that with this part. Like for example, yesterday we did the meditation in the morning, I think, with the positive, neutral, and negative feelings. And the intention behind that is to be able to amplify or diminish these sensations. So I intentionally let everyone stay with each sensation for the same amount of time. Because normally we want to stay pleasant the most time, 3 minutes, neutral, 2, and then 1 for like a painful feeling. But to really be aware of each sensation and where it resonates on the body, to be able to go back to amplify or replicate that. So when we start sitting in the morning, our sitting session in general, the instruction is usually to gladden the mind. To make the mind bright. So the teaching about the smile, I mean, that's a physical act that brightens the mind. And so it's easier to slip into meditation. So another way I think about that is to maintain mindfulness throughout the normal day. So when you sit down to meditate, it's easy for the mind to slip into meditation, to just focus. And I actually do have pain. I just thought about it because I have pain. I usually have pain at the center of my back because I usually tilt forward. I've always tried to hide my chest because I started to develop early when I was a preteen. So I would hunch like this. So I have pain in my back, but I really don't notice it anymore because the lower half of my body, like from my head down, generally feels like in a pleasant cloud, like a golden, pleasant cloud. And it kind of holds, like Marcel was saying, like it holds the rest of my body. So I don't even notice it. Like I have to intentionally find it in my body where it's painful. Sometimes I get pain in my left hip. This is why I'm sitting like this with my leg up. But it's not at the forefront of my mind. In the past, it has been. That's all I used to be able to think about. And then it would kind of amplify because I would focus on it. So now it's diminished because I've amplified a positive sensation, which is almost always positive. Almost always. And even the neutral sensation can be transformed into something pleasant just for the lack of the absence of the pain. I just wanted to add that. Okay. About something with.
Practices for folks who I think that the practices for folks who can't do walking meditation, sitting meditation in a chair is meditation as well. I know there are some traditions that, you know, you have to sit full lotus and back always straight and head erect, and that is a that's a posture. I mean, in our sangha, you know, we always open with this is let's sit in this position, and it's a stable position, right? If you fall asleep, you really don't fall down.
It's true.
So there is something to that, that's when we think way back, the ideology of some of this, it's very stable. You don't, I know people who've fallen asleep and I've fallen asleep and you're right there and then you're like, and you don't, you flip. Okay, so there's a there's a practical thing here. It's also, you know, sitting up in this posture, it also allows the flow. If you think of the body and the channels, you know, there is that's real. You know, the channels are open. I mean, you know, when you sit up and you visualize your vertebrae are open and things flow. So there is something to the postures, but walking meditation is, you don't have to do walking meditation. You don't have to stand and do meditation. You can sit. There's nothing inferior about someone sitting on a chair to meditate. So I think that's something that needs to be totally like removed from the perception that sitting in a chair is not real meditation. I know there are traditions that would be right there in front of me and say I'm wrong. But the truth is in what's the result of our practice. And if we're reaching the states of samadhi and tranquility and spaces where we can gain insight, however we're doing our meditation, following our breath or in focusing an object, this is really, it's a skillful means. Don't get caught up in the like form of it. It's a means, it's a tool to get us to a place of clear understanding and love. And it may look different for many people. Maybe 30% of us here don't regularly sit on a cushion. And maybe that's a percent of the population. And then maybe 50% like to sit lotus or full lotus. But that's just because there's a collective consciousness that's what you do when you know, Buddhists sit in lotus. And all the images are this little Buddha like this, right? So there's a collective consciousness of that. And we respect that because that's where the teachings come from. And we also respect our body and how we show up in this world with our generational of who we are. So I don't know if that's what the question is getting at is as far as the form of the sitting and what it is that we say is appropriate ways to gain insight and understanding. It's whatever brings your mind. Some people only do walking meditation. What do you know, that, and they're finding their insight via that route. Some people do laying meditation. There are some traditions that would just excommunicate them from their tradition because they're like doing laying. No, that's just sleep. What's this deep relaxation thing that they do in that Plum Village tradition? That's real. We hear that, right? What is that all about? Well, that's meditation because you're bringing your mind to focus. Thich Nhat Hanh says that whenever your mind and body comes together, that's what mindfulness is about. That is meditation. But every tradition has its kind of like sets of practices that, you know, you kind of say, oh yeah, that's insight, you know, oh yeah, and it's okay, you know, you go and maybe that fits you, but we can't minimize that however we find a way to find stillness so that we can begin to notice and get clarity about who this very self is and how it engages in the world. Whatever your process is, besides LSD, right? Because that was the reason that people said they needed LSD, so they could know themselves. I've used this example because it's there's always a you know, there's a normal distribution that people fit into this curve, 80, whatever it is, 9 whatever percent, 78.7%, right? That fits into that curve that will all sit and do this, and that's fine. And then there's always people are out who are outside, and they're as normal as the ones who sit on the cushion with their legs fully, you know, in lotus or not, or do walking meditation. So I don't think it's an obstacle.
And also the sutra that we read this morning, that's one of the universal across all traditions, and always going back to like the full awareness of breathing sutra and the four establishments of mindfulness. And you notice walking was one of the postures. Yeah. Well, and there's a sutra about a monk who, it's kind of a play off this. He was experiencing a lot of restlessness. So he was doing walking meditation so much like through the whole night, days on end, that his feet started to bleed because he really wanted to be liberated. And the Buddha said, you need to sit. Just sit down, stop walking. I mean, it was just that simple. So you can do the same for the opposite. Just walk. For me, the past about 6 months has been very difficult for me to sit. And I'm coming from the opposite end where I love it, feels great, but there's this need to move. So I've been practicing walking meditation much more than I usually do, because that is it helps me get into a different space, which is also clarity, but in a different form, a different avenue to get there. Okay.
That's good.
Yeah. So this is the stack about social justice, I guess, environment. No, well, one environment, social justice, dealing with structures of oppression. How does one incorporate some of these practices in a capitalist workplace that reinforces white supremacy and productivity over human connection and compassion? And I really like this part. We all have to eat. Da, da, da. what are some healthy practices for leaving work at work, setting boundaries? How do you talk to people in a gentle way but still get your point across? Things about identity and separation, division and separation. How does identity support interbeing? Oh, how do you turn beautiful moments of connection and insight into a life of activism? Can there be a right activism? I think this is kind of like a play off the Eightfold Path, like right concentration, right livelihood, the connection, right livelihood. And there was one question again about the quality complex. So just to be clear about that, I think what they were saying is what we were saying as well. We were with that. That's not what we're aiming for. Much more, something beyond that. Marcella, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think, so there's often a question, or at least I often get a question about how do we practice in activism space? And several of those questions get at that. And you know, there's ways we can say like, okay, so when you, so in a meeting, before a, say a meeting around some issue, in an environmental justice meeting, maybe we take a few moments to breathe before a meeting, right? Kind of these practical kind of structural things that we embed, we bring into our spaces. So we're having a meeting and, you know, you don't even have to say that, you know, this is Buddhist or whatever metaphysical or new age, whatever the word is that people might ascribe to it. Sometimes it's just, can we just take a moment right now to just like get present in a room. Can we take one breath? In the middle of a meeting, especially if there's things going crazy, if we have the if we are mindful to remember, we can invite someone to the group to breathe. At the end of the meeting, we can stop and breathe. There's now like some directions on how to hold a meeting more mindfully, which is actually setting up a framework so that, and it has to do with not interrupting, listening to when, say I'm finished when I'm finished, kind of what is on the guidelines. So there's out there now more, I think, specific instructions of how to engage in these spaces that are typically, you know, acting in this productivity way. And I think all that's great. What I do think is that this path of practice, that there's not a set of practices per se that we take and now we put it into these different spaces that are acting in more capitalist or neoliberal or whatever ways. That what happens is that as we practice over and over again, our very selves become transformed. And the self that we take into those spaces, wherever they are, is that transformed self. And therefore, that transformed self is naturally going to bring something different into that space. So this saying that there is no way to peace, peace is the way. This is it, right? Because as we practice, we're going to, you've already been transforming because you've been practicing. You're noticing your speech. When you eat, you're thinking differently. When you're walking, you may forget 90% of the time, but there's a percentage of time maybe you'll remember, like, oh yeah, breathe at the stoplight, right? And those things, those small moments of awareness are transforming us. And as we transform and we go back into those spaces that we're used to being a certain way, we're going to be that transformed way. People are going to notice us, right? And we won't be able to help ourselves. I can't help myself. So, like, when I go home, and, you know, they say our home is the hardest place to practice, even harder than those capitalist productive spaces. My mom, she doesn't know what's transpired over the last 10, 15 years. But and Buddhism, so every breath, right? Like, so the bell rings and we take a breath. Every breath brings us closer to that transformation, right? You know, there's some traditions that actually, the way they determine, you know, where you are on this path, I'm not trying to quantitate, but there are traditions that do this. They ask you how many hours of meditation, how many hours of sit practice you have, right? So why do they do that? They do that because every breath in mindfulness is a breath that's re-imprinting this neural pathway of who we are. And so those 10 breaths that we just took, that moved you along a little bit. And this weekend retreat and stepping mindfully and breathing, that moved you along. It's as exact a science as that. So the more, that's why I say, go home and practice, and then find a sangha and practice when you need structure. Because it's every moment, every step that we can remember brings us closer to remembering again. The more often we remember, the more often we will remember. Because we're re-imprinting, we're actually causing shifts in our neural imprints that are making us act and be different. So as I was saying, when I went home, my mom couldn't even fathom, like, what had transpired. Buddhism, she's very Catholic, You know, it's like the devil, the Buddha, big guy with a big belly. But once my aunt said, what do y'all do? Like sit around and rub the Buddha's belly? I'm like, okay. But what all, and I said, what? Like, do you have a problem with this? My mom, she said, I don't understand any of it, but all I know is that you're not as angry. Mm. Right? Because I had become the change, because it was in me. So it didn't matter what I said to her. She wouldn't be convinced. All she could see was I wasn't carrying the world. The angry black woman wasn't there in her face anymore. Right? And that's what you become. So you bring that transformed self into all those capitalist spaces, those crazy paternalist sick spaces, those anti-immigrant spaces, those spaces of class discrimination. You bring that self into that. And people take notice. And people say, I don't know what you did, but I want some of it. And what's that it? The it is the transformed nature that we are now bringing into the space. So for me, all those questions come back into that. We have to practice. And I want to touch on the structure part. There was a question about structure and personal practice. One of the most important things in practice, the Buddha says, was admirable friendship. And admirable friendship, in some interpretations, is interpreted as the Buddha. The Buddha was our most admirable friend, because he showed us the way, he practiced and showed us a path. In our everyday walkings, our admirable friendship is you and you and you. There are people who we see practicing who remind us that this is the way to enlightenment, this is the way of waking up. And where we find that is in Sangha, in community. And so we can be at home and we can practice by ourselves, and I think we should have a personal practice, whether it's 10 minutes in the morning or 10 minutes at night. And then we go to practice, because we need, none of us are at the place yet, and forgive me if I'm speaking, where we can be by ourselves and maintain that structure of practice. We still need admirable friendships. And those come in the form of community. So we practice at home, and we maintain the practice, and then we go back into Sangha and we get supported, and then we go home, and it's like that. And you will know when you don't need the structure anymore. You will know. And when you're at home, you have your own structure. It's just like getting up. Every morning you get up and brush your teeth, right? Nobody has to tell you anymore. That's what practice should be like. You should figure out in your daily schedule, just like as important as it is to brush your teeth, it's important to practice. That's what it needs to come to that. That's structure. Because you had to learn how to brush your teeth. You didn't really want to brush your teeth.
Okay.
So. Sister?
That was perfect. There was one. Okay, there was one thing. Give me a second to think about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it was interacting with people who are difficult.
The black hole.
Huh?
The black hole.
Oh, are the black hole energy in a negative way? That's like one of my nicknames, black hole, because people can absorb the energy of other people and they can just talk. Maybe he's laughing, like, how can I make my speech clear, honest, and direct, yet loving when dealing with injustice around me? Mm-hmm. That's a really great one. So there's a few guidelines in terms of Buddhist speech. One is truth, another one is timeliness, another one is... is it appropriate if the person is in an appropriate space to hear it? Because sometimes they're not. If you're in an appropriate space to say something, is it kind and gentle? And I think that that's like the one that's the hardest to practice with, because at least for me, because that was something that got me onto the path, my horrible, horrible speech. So I had a moment in my, now I can say early 20s, where I was really, really drunk, really high, and just ranting at my friends. And this is like a life-changing moment for me, where I actually heard myself talk, and it was the same same words and tone, cadence that my stepfather, who was an alcoholic, spoke to my mother for years and years and years. And then I realized it was not him, actually, it was his father who spoke to his mother like that for years and years and years. So it was like this hereditary thing. So that was a big wake-up call for me in terms of speech, because I spoke very direct. I was brutally honest, but brutally. It was very direct, very sharp. I could call you out about anything and with a smile on my face. And that was like the disconnect, because it seemed like I was being speaking appropriately. I was just being honest. Mm. I'm just telling like it was. You know, they need to hear it. That type of thing. So my practice in the beginning was to shut up. Like, I was just talking way too much, way too much. There was no space for me to hear the other person, and also to hear myself, to see what was going on, what was driving me to speak in that manner. And a lot of it was not being heard myself, so I decided to start listening more. So I became the black hole. I started to develop the capacity to hold other people's speech. And a lot of it in the beginning, because I feel like this overcompensating was because I was very sensitive. Like, my feelings got hurt really easily. Like, the stuff I would say to people would just demolish me. So I had to start not only holding the space in a different manner, similar to the technique that we do in Dharma sharing, like repeating it back, not adding the commentary, because that's where it got me, the commentary. It's like, they said this in my head, they meant that, something else, and then that's what I would react to. So clearing the space in my mind for that, and then starting to accumulate new vocabulary. So I stopped cursing. That was hard. That was so hard. I stopped speaking so sharply. So I practiced to, and this is what Plum Village is like known for, especially in monastic communities. We're known for being very gentle in speech, especially. Like, we don't say like, that's ugly. We say that's not so beautiful. So that over embellishment of the positive, sweet, lovey-dovey language was actually really helpful. I don't speak like that normally. I call it temple talk. I don't speak like that normally, but it was a good training for me to kind of recalibrate back to something more wholesome, because I was on this end. So when I deal with people who speak like that, the first reflection is, let me just let them talk, because sometimes they're just bubbling over, and that's just how they share. They don't have the not material, but they just don't know how to do it. They don't have the framework, like nonviolent communication. Don't particularly like that style of speaking, but it's really helpful because it gives you a framework of how to speak, and not everyone has that knowledge. So I let them speak, and then I also reflect on how I was just like that, almost to a T sometimes. It's kind of shocking, and it's like, oh, wow. And I happened to be in the monastery during the last election, so we got a huge influx of people coming in with a lot of suffering for that. But before, I remember sitting in a sangha, and the facilitator just said, "I am Trump," and I was like, "What does she mean?" Like, it was all automatically like, "Oh my god!" Like, it was like, "What is that actually mean though?" Mm-hmm. And then I reflected on that, and I thought, wow, I was just like Trump. I mean, I was on cocaine when I was like Trump, but you know, I was just like him. Just like him. So I didn't have this. So when I interact with people like that or hear his particular speech, I don't automatically wall off or distance myself. But I try to listen more deeply to what they're saying. For him, it's nonsense. A lot of time, there's something else there. But for people that we interact with personally, like this, there's usually something deeper that they're getting at. So I had, I was trained really well in terms of that, to put it lightly. So a lot of sharpness are a lot of misunderstandings. So my practice was to not say anything, not to like fan the flames, not to engage with it, but to create that space to see what they were actually saying, and then try to maneuver the conversation and not manipulate it, but just gently push it into a different direction. So actually Marcella is really, really good with this with me, especially a few years ago. I would have kind of a fluttering of energy, like being really excited, and she just like gently like guide me back to something more calm. I don't know if you remember that, but it happened a lot. And it was actually quite helpful because I needed that reminder that I don't want to go in that direction of this type of speech. But it takes practice, and I have to remember that. But when I hear myself, I try to reflect, is it me? Is it someone I would look up to or admire? Or is it like my stepdad? Or is it me like 10 years ago? Or is it that comedian I really liked from high school, but that's not really appropriate? Like, because, you know, the humor is not really appropriate. That's another tricky area, humor. Like, what do you find funny? That's a big one. Like for me, it was, I loved Kevin Hart and Dave Chappelle. So like, it's all hard. I love all that type of stuff. Now I can't really watch it. Like the way I see stuff and take stuff in has changed. Man, I love South Park though.
South Park is funny.
It is funny. It's a little bit too rough for me though. But yeah, that's all I wanted to add.
That's great.
Okay, so the last pile, there's two more practical things. Mm-hmm. So the last pile is, oh, that's resources. Speech, oh. Kind of grief. This one was about the grief and the,
I think we
touched on that. Okay, so the practical stuff. Mm-hmm. Tools for bringing mindfulness to young people, like resources. Also, are the chants written down? Yes and yes. So this is the Plum Village chanting book, Chanting from the Heart. It's almost all the chants actually are available online. So sanghas like Baltimore and Beyond, our Waker sanghas, individual groups often post stuff on their own sites. And then plumvillage.org also posts like all this online, but here's a hard copy of it. And there's sutras in here. There are ceremonies. There are the gathas, like we see posted up around. These gathas, we have to, as novices, we had to memorize those. There's about 62. and they're also part of the chanting. So the morning chant and the evening chant are gathas for the bells. Like listening to the bell. We also recite, that's why I take a pause before I actually invite the bell. I'm reciting a gatha. So it helps me kind of center, and then also helps me to be aware of the energy I'm putting out, because you can tell when someone's agitated and they invite the bell. And that energy pervades out. So that's this. And there's a couple of books on mindfulness for teenagers, the mindful teen. Mm-hmm. Don't know, I'm sure there's a lot of other resources, but Plum Village's publishing company is called Parallax Press, so you can go on to Parallax Press and see all of the books and CDs, calendars, audio.
There's actually a
Parallax
Press book called came out maybe a few years ago from Plum Village. That's written specifically about how to incorporate mindfulness practices in education settings, in classrooms.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, Happy Teachers Change the World.
Yeah,
that's a really good one too, if you're an educator. Really, really good. Good. And it has things from for small children up to teenagers and young adults as well. That's like our manual when we do the children's program, the teens program.
And they have a good website, actually, that the educators, the Palm Village educators have a great website.
Oh, yeah. I think that's it.
The environmental justice one, specifically about resources. So in Palm Village, we also have the Earth Holder Sangha, and they're very, very active in environmental justice. So I would go to just Google Earth Holder Sangha, and there's a lot of resources. They're doing a lot of very awesome stuff.
And real quick, so Parallax is usually full price for the book. If you can't afford that, I have a lot of digital copies of things, so please feel free to email me and I can get you a copy of it somehow, like a soft digital copy. I'll have like a card or something later.
I wanted to add one thing around the pain and meditation, and another practice is reciting mantras, chanting sutras, metta meditation, like the meditation we did yesterday, which is also, but there's a lot of metta practices. But actually, these kinds of sending metta is really actually a good practice for pain, because it's kind of going away from the body, and then it's bringing the mind to this space through the repetition of the chant and the mantra and the metta, and it brings us into a space after we start doing it over and over again. So for people with chronic pain who can't go inward, you might want to look into that as well. There's Lojong practices, which are also very nice, because it looks at bringing, some people say don't do that unless you're fully able, but there's also some who say that when you focus on, in this loving way, on others' pain, the energy, that the merit that comes from that also spreads to relieve your pain. So there's these kind of external practices that you can also incorporate. My favorite question or comment was, I like the silence. with that, we are exactly just late enough.